liked in music, the capacity to sort of direct inject into the emotional system. And for me, I think I've enjoyed other people's work when they've sort of put a lot of themselves, good, bad and ugly, into their work. Well, I think initially therapy for me, in a way, that I can put all the suffering and misery that I go through and put it into the music and then flush it out in the world and walk away smiling.
Hi, this is Peter Gabriel, and I'm here to talk about So, which is probably more So, but here we go.
As the leader of Genesis in the early 1970s, Peter Gabriel helped move progressive rock to new levels of theatricality, declares Stephen Thomas Erlewine on AllMusic.com. And while true that as the lead singer of Genesis, Peter garnered the lion's share of attention, Gabriel's departure following the band's 1975 album and tour, The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, accomplished a rarity in rock. It allowed the individual band members in Genesis to blossom into superstars, while simultaneously launching Peter Gabriel's highly acclaimed solo career. By 1982, Gabriel had released four studio albums containing a string of quirky, memorable songs including Salisbury Hill, Games Without Frontiers, a song about murdered African apartheid activist Stephen Biko, and Gabriel's first U.S. hit in 1982, Shock the Monkey. That startling video to the song came at the advent of MTV, music television, as they dawned in North America, and that video's far-reaching impact set the stage 4 years later for Peter Gabriel's masterpiece in May 1986, entitled So. In front of a live, small studio audience, I'm joined in the studio by Peter Gabriel.
You know, Peter, when I first became a fan of yours, you were writing and singing predominantly fantasy scenarios as the vocalist and lyricist of early Genesis. At what point did reality become more intriguing than fantasy as song subjects?
It's probably to do with getting older, too. I was just very caught up with dreams and that world, which still sort of resonates strongly for me, but I think the hard facts have played a bigger part for me, and you know, I felt more able to address them directly.
Fantasy morality plays, like fairy tales, can be nonetheless very useful in learning about the real world. Would you agree?
Definitely. I mean, I think as many other cultures have valued storytelling more than we do at this time.
the trust of a giant.
The song that leads off Peter Gabriel's So album, The Powerful Red Rain, was inspired by a dream amidst real-life reports at the time of a catastrophic nuclear reactor meltdown at Chernobyl in the then-communist Soviet Union, lending an ominous weight to the song when we first heard it in May 1986. Once again, here's Peter Gabriel with me in the studio.
It's very easy to forget how interconnected we are, and what is clear when you see Chernobyl, when you see how the climate is being affected by what the different countries are doing, that events taking place outside of our borders, whoever we are without question having enormous impact on our lives. So it's ridiculous to think in any other way than planetary.
We're talking with Peter Gabriel. Peter, you and I spoke earlier about importing the music from other lands into the West. Matter of fact, you have a Real World Records, which you are involved in. How do you feel about the exportation of Western culture and ideals to these same ancient cultures? Why does it seem impossible for us to observe and learn from these ancient cultures without dominating them?
Well, I think it's tied up with a lot of political and economic issues, and I think there is a way that there's an exchange that can take place, which is sort of from person to person rather than sort of government to government and big business to big business. And I think that's a much healthier foundation for some of that interaction, although obviously governments need to work together. But there is a great danger, I think, as has been seen in a lot of funding projects in the past, and that political intentions of the funders get mixed up with the
good intentions.
The giving, sometimes good intentions, sometimes not so good. But I think, you know, they probably look pretty good to the people generating them.
Self-serving, then.
Yeah, I would definitely say self-serving.
Alrighty. It seems it goes all the way back to the Crusades 1,000 years ago. With it almost, I'm wondering if maybe it's possibly almost religiously motivated. For some reason, we can't seem in the West to observe and learn. We've got to go and dilute these ancient cultures that were there a long time before we were.
Yeah, but I think they're also living cultures, you know, and they have a real sort of strength that probably isn't going to bend or flinch too much, regardless of what we do. So, in a way, you know, I think they are their own best defense.
Peter, the video to Shock the Monkey is one of the landmark works in rock video history. Its impact and influence is felt here years later. You seem very adept at the medium of putting music together with visuals. How did you get this down? Did you take film, possibly in art school, or does it just seem to come naturally? Is something that's interesting to you?
I think it's mainly working with the right people, but I mean, I do love to get involved with the images, and I take time over it, which I think some musicians don't really like to do. And that always seems crazy to me, you know, if you spend an enormous amount of time working on the music, that you don't put some effort into the way it's interpreted. But the Shock the Monkey video was an excellent director, Brian Grant, and so it's partly the quality of the people. But for my own part, I've always loved film, and the soundtracks are great source of pleasure for me to work with great directors. And originally I had a place at a film school in London, and there was a toss-up when things were going really badly with the group whether I would take that or music. But I think music was too far in my blood. So
any chance that you would do that again with another major film?
Well, I'm still interested, and the question then is time, you know, because there are a lot of other interesting things that may or may not come to be, and it's a medium I'm still interested in, and I think I can learn a lot. And in a sense, not having lyrics on the songs or song structures frees up the way that the arrangements get put together, and I think did definitely teach me a lot in terms of the passion record. So although it's sometimes seen as a distraction by my record companies.
Kate Bush duetted with you on the So album. Are these songs, are they conceived as duets, or do they kind of evolve that way?
It sort of goes that way, really. I mean, it was more, for me, I know when I'm listening back, I get bored of my own voice after a certain period, you know, and I think I try and get the stuff right so it'll stand up to a few listens. And I think having other vocal textures, and it's, I mean, not just Sinead or Kate, but friends, and Daniel too does a little bit of Daniel Lenoir, that is, a bit of singing. And I think that helps to make for a long life, you know, because I think close on an hour of the one person's voice only can get a little heavy. So it's an emotional punctuation point as well as a wonderful color in itself.
In this proud land we grew up strong. We were wanted all along. I was taught to fight, taught to win. I never thought I could fail. No fight left, or so it seems. I am a man whose dreams have all. I've changed my name, but no one wants you when you lose.
Don't give up. your head. You worry too much. It's gonna be alright. When times get rough, you can't fall back on us. Don't give up. Please don't give up.
Soothing song Don't Give Up on Peter Gabriel's album So features the distinctive vocal textures of Gabriel plus the one and only Kate Bush. When we return, Peter explores his propensity for copying a great groove. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Peter Gabriel in the studio for the 5th anniversary of his quintuple platinum album So.
Hi, this is Peter Gabriel, and I'm here to talk about So, which is probably more So, but here we go.
Welcome back in the studio with Peter Gabriel for the anniversary of the So album, which Rolling Stone magazine ranks at number 185 on their top 500 albums of all time. I'm Redbeard. I asked Peter Gabriel about his motivation, obvious or subtle, in making music.
I think I've always worked from the rhythm first, because if you get a great groove happening, then it's sort of downhill, you know, you can take your hands off the keyboard and shut your mouth for a moment and the thing still feels great. So what we tend to do is get a groove happening and then we manipulate it a little bit, add stuff to it.
How did you find this international cast of characters?
Well, I'm very lucky that I found a lot of them just by looking out the window.
How do you mean?
Well, we've got a setup now, which is not originally by design for my benefit, but it has worked that way. Years ago, we started a thing called WOMAD, which was a festival of world music, really. WOMAD stands for World of Music, Arts and Dance. And at that time, a few of us were getting enthusiastic about the music that we were hearing, and it was impossible to find in record stores. It was impossible to read about, see on television, etc. So we thought of putting a concert together, which could perhaps grow into a festival to include rock bands and musicians from around the world. So, I mean, on the rock side, it included people like Simple Minds and Echo and the Bunnymen, myself. And we also have a small label now, Real World Records, where we get artists from many different countries to come in. And they were coming into this festival and unable to get deals. So it was partly for that reason and for the fact that I was building this studio that we started to get the record label together. So long and short of it is that probably as many sort of touring musicians from other countries come through our little village as come through London.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's extremely fortunate.
Sledgehammer, why don't you call my name? You better call the sledgehammer.
feast of musical flavors brought to a boil, including Peter Gabriel's cheesy roller rink organ, Motown soul brass, and Memphis Stax guitar licks, all combined in the song Sledgehammer, which ended up as a number one hit in the U.S., number four in the U.K.
A great relationship with a superb core band of musicians. How long has the relationship been ongoing? How long has this core band been working with you now? And can you give me, some of their individual influences or contributions?
Well, I've been able to work with great musicians, really from the word go. But after I left Genesis, which is not to say that I didn't like them as musicians, because I think they were doing some wonderful things. And but just obviously, when you're on your own, you get a chance to choosing people and making changes. And, sure. It's a bit of mix and match with the songs too, as well. I have wonderful advantage of having a really good relationship with the guys that play with me, who are really strong in what they do. And yet, I can invite other people in and augment stuff as well. I think some of the bass playing has drawn a lot of attention on this record. And Tony was actually working on the very first record that I did after leaving Genesis. And that was sometime back now. Of course, neither of us have aged since then.
Not at all. Not a lick. He's talking about Tony Levin, who is one of the most respected bass player musicians in the world.
Yeah, and he can be, although he was known more for some of his jazz and work, which was sort of quieter work originally with Judy Collins and Paul Simon in this old format. He can become a wild rocker, he takes off his suit and puts on a pair of leather trousers. But he's an extraordinary musician and was doing some of this, what we called Indian bass or slightly psychedelic bass playing. And Manu, I think, is one of the finest drummers in the world, and I was very lucky, because I started working with him on So, and it was just speculative in a way. I hadn't really heard him. I'd never heard him play, and it was just a friend had recommended him.
Really?
Yeah, so I didn't know if it was going to work out.
A very good friend, it turned out to be.
Yeah, it was an excellent recommendation. And he'd only really been known in France before then. But obviously, as soon as he sat down, I knew there was a master drummer there. And David Rhodes was playing guitar originally at art school. And as I said earlier, this was almost a hobby, his music. But he's now, I think, a very serious player. And each record he does, he puts more in. So I had a great core. And David Sanctius, who's been playing with me a lot live, was on the road with Sting. I mean, Sting and I have ended up getting into some musician swapping parties.
Sounds a little sordid. Yeah.
And suburban life for you. It ended up with me doing a lot more keyboards, which I actually really enjoyed. So I think it's a wonderful core, and before that I worked with wonderful musicians. So I think I learn a lot too from people I work with, and they all sort of make contributions and get their own style within the larger bracket, which is my music.
Looking down on empty streets, all she can see are the dreams all made solid, are the dreams made real. All of the buildings, all of the cars were once just a dream in somebody's head. She pictures the broken glass, pictures the steam. She pictures a soul with no leak at the seams. Take the boat out, wait until darkness. Let's take the boat out, wait until darkness. Nowhere in the corridors of pale green and grey, nowhere in the suburbs in the cold light of day. There in the midst of it, so alive and alone, words support like bone, dreaming of mercy. Mercy in your daddy's. hearts, tugging at the darkness, word on word, confessing all those secret things in a warm velvet box to the priest. He's the doctor, he can handle the shocks. Dreaming of the tenderness that tremble in the hips of kissing Mary's lips. Dreaming of mercy.
That's in short supply these days. Peter Gabriel, Dreaming of Mercy Street, Wearing Your Inside Out, voted by the readers of Q magazine as the number 81 greatest album ever.
I'm with the father, he's out in the boat, riding the water, riding the waves on the sea.
Still to come, Peter Gabriel reveals what it was that inspired him to be a musician, why he's been a proponent of world music, his activism for disenfranchised people worldwide, and how a notorious incident of oppression in mid-80s America transformed into a movement whose legacy lives on in today's Black Lives Matter initiative, among others. Follow In the Studio on Facebook. Find your favorite musician interviews at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Peter Gabriel on the 30th anniversary of So.
Hi, this is Peter Gabriel, and I'm here to talk about So, which is probably more so, but here we go.
Welcome back in the studio with Peter Gabriel on the 30th anniversary of his biggest album, 1986 album, So. I'm Redbeard.
There's more of a groove and a funk, though, to much of your music than just the rhythmic parts. What timeless qualities of the best Motown and the Memphis Stax songs and those New Orleans meter songs, what timeless qualities still work for you today? What about that stuff just seems to be like you can't top it even today?
No, I think there's still some extraordinary rhythm, soulful playing. I mean, it's with great vitality and passion. And that was definitely a formative time for me. It was one of the things that made me decide I wanted to be a musician.
Mm.
You know, and having the privilege of seeing Otis Redding perform live and stuff like this was just extraordinary.
Mm.
Hi there. I'm on my way. I'm making it. I'm gonna watch you.
Big Time from Peter Gabriel's So album peaked at number 8 in the US, number 13 in the UK, and helped Gabriel earn no less than 4 Grammy nominations for 1986.
How has the artistic and the commercial success of the So album affected your ability to organize and initiate worthwhile projects and motivate others?
I think it's made a lot of difference for me. I mean, a lot of opportunities came up then. And most of the income was ploughed into the studio. It's sort of also known as a graveyard for royalties. But it's given me wonderful opportunities, you know, and we get a lot of interesting things recorded and sort of an endless flow of interesting musicians. And quite often it's spontaneous. There was a Mongolian group that got stuck in Wales and someone said they were doing great things, so we invited them down the next day.
You, Peter, combine a passion for the arts with tireless efforts for human rights. And I get the impression from following your career that for you, the arts are a means to an end, kind of inexorably tied to communicating the human condition. True?
Well, I think I'm still, you know, basically a musician doing the things I love to do. And, I don't think I really set out with a great platform on the human rights front. It's just, when you start meeting people and talking to people and getting one-on-one requests, it's just very difficult to walk away from.
Oh, but you could turn them down. I'm sure others do.
Well, I do turn a lot down, you know, and it's still, you know, it's very easy for us in some ways because we just come in and out for relatively short periods of our lives and walk away from the problems, whereas people quite often that we're trying to work with are left with them.
Living them.
Yeah.
So lost sometimes, days pass, and this emptiness fills my heart. When I want to run away, I drive off in my car, but whichever. destruction of all the fruitless soldiers. Oh, I see the light and the heat. Oh, I wanna be that complete. I wanna touch the light, the heat I see in your eyes.
Out of In Your Eyes, featuring the distinctive vocals of West African Youssou N'Dour. Here again is Peter Gabriel.
But things that you did not walk away from, matter of fact, you embraced your involvement in the 86 Amnesty International tour and the 88 Human Rights Now tour with the likes of Bruce Springsteen, Sting, Tracy Chapman, Youssou N'Dour.
Those were great experiences though, for us also, in that by traveling around the country and getting to meet people in all the different places, you got a very different view of the human rights situation. And in fact, another project which got involved in called Witness was partly as a result of that touring, because a lot of the people you'd meet would say, you know, if only everyone else in the world knew what was going on here, I'm sure they'd do something. I'm not sure they were right. I'm not sure people will always do something. I mean, we get so many calls on compassion in our purses or whatever, and it's hard for a lot of people right now. But it was clear that if there was evidence of what was going on, then in certain cases there would be a lot of pressure put on governments and embarrassment, as Amnesty has proved time and time again, does get results. You know, nobody likes to be a bad guy in the diplomatic circles. So because it affects sort of political and economic futures. So the aim was very simple, was just to get a lot of camcorders in the hands of human rights activists. And the aim is really to act as a service to the other human rights organizations who are acting as advisors. And it was really the Rodney King beatings that changed people's opinions of how powerful a small strip of videotape can be.
Called Courage from Peter Gabriel. It's a So outtake that was finished some 25 years later. It's great. I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio thanking my guest Peter Gabriel. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2016. All rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net.